You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
This was me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm joined today with my guest, Kelly Narowski. How are you doing today, Kelly?
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me. I'm doing well. You?
And I'm feeling horrible. I didn't ask you. Did I get the last name right?
Narowski. You did. Most people don't.
Perfect. Hey. Okay. I just wanted to make sure. I didn't want to. I wasn't going to go the whole interview with having that being wrong. So let's just kind of start with who you are and what you do and how we met, because I think that's kind of an interesting story. And I think it'll probably be better if you tell it, I'm guessing.
Okay. We met under unfortunate circumstances, but you helped me so much. I'll be happy to share that. So I'm a professional speaker. I live in Kansas City, and I'm also a disability rights advocate, just for a little background for your audience. I have a bit of a social media presence, not a big influencer or anything like that, but my business, because of my business and speaking, I am on several social media platforms, and I have a personal Facebook page, which I'm active on, and I was on Facebook more than anything else, and I had around 2,600 Facebook friends, and then I had a professional page for my speaking, which was tied to the personal page, and it had close to 3,000 followers, but they were actually different than the Facebook friends because of a viral reel that I had that had a few million views by chance. And the reason that's relevant is because how you helped me deal with all of this, or what a loss it was, I should say. Basically, one day I started getting all these texts, people wanting to buy cars. It was a Saturday morning. I woke up and then my husband came in and said, "Did you get my message?" And he said, "People are selling cars on your Facebook page." So apparently I was hacked. Somebody got in there. I was locked out. I was upset, called the bank, you know, didn't know what was going on, called the credit card company. And a couple of days went by and it was just a nightmare. I couldn't get in there to get it fixed. Facebook wouldn't answer me, tried absolutely everything that ChatGPT told me to do, that my techie friends told me to do. And then my real estate agent said that you were great. You'd helped a friend of hers and gave me your name and number. And she raved about you. And I don't know the friend's name. I just, my real estate agent highly recommended you. So I reached out to you like a few days after this happened and met with you. And you're able to help me figure out what's going on. And the hackers got into my email and stole my copy of my driver's license and kept proving to Facebook that they were me. And a lot of Facebook friends would report the activity, and Facebook would shut them down. They would show my driver's license to Facebook, and then they kept putting it back up, and it just went round and round for about a week. And you helped me. We couldn't get rid of them, but because they're out of the country and it's really kind of impossible, but you were able to get my 3,200 and something pictures off there quickly before it was shut down, and helped me figure out that this was coming through via email and get them out of the email account. I guess that was the long story, but that was pretty traumatic. That was a really big violation. You hear about these things happening. Until it happens to you, you don't realize how painful it is, the emotional turmoil.
Yeah. Is that something you're interested in talking about, the emotional turmoil? Because there's kind of a bit of a theme. Had a couple instances of that come up almost all at once. And I think, you know, for me and for other technicians, and I'll shame us a little bit for a second. We kind of live in this world. And so I think sometimes maybe we're, for lack of any better term, perhaps a little bit cold to the emotional element of when it happens to you and you're just not sure how to deal with it, right? Like if it happened to me, my mind almost kind of goes into this cold, methodical, like, okay, work to prevent this, but now it's happened. Here's the things that I'm going to start to do to try to regain ground, almost like a active battlefield, so to speak. But so I want to, for myself and others, kind of seek to understand how that was for you, though.
Well, it was, like I said, it was much worse than I would have thought. My professional page had all my speaking reviews on it from clients, and then, you know, lots of different posts and things. So it's hurting. It hurt my business. It just makes you feel so out of control. I thought you were very kind. You stayed with me when I was very upset. And we stayed with me, an extra half hour at least while we tried to work this out. And you acted part cybersecurity helper and part counselor a little bit. So just trying to get me through the moment. But that was, I remember making a comment to you. I mean, once I found out earlier this year they had breast cancer, I remember saying, since it was early stage, and it's very curable, early stages, I said that this felt worse than breast cancer because I knew there was could do something about it. We couldn't solve this. And, you know, I lost all those followers and they were trying to get into my Instagram and all that. But anyway, it was just really painful. And I was crying a lot for over a week. So I thought you were very kind and empathetic. And I can see what you're saying, though, how the people in your business would be a little desensitized to these bad actors and their behavior.
Yeah, and I wish I had a better term for it, because I mean we're definitely aware of the fact that we're in and helping protect people's livelihoods for sure. And I do try to leave emotional space too, but it's just, I think part of a protective element, so to speak, is that, well, anyway, this is, you know, enough about me. So what are you doing currently, Kelly? So you said, you know, you're a professional speaker and you had the page. Can you tell me about what it is you're speaking on and the advocacy that you're doing?
Certainly. So I give speeches about various topics. I heard on a podcast one time, I think it was Rich Roll's guest, that said, make your mess your message. So I have several messes in life, and so I have several messages. So there's several topics that I speak on. Sometimes I'm asked to come in and do injury prevention, like at high schools and colleges. So brain and spinal cord injury prevention, talk about seatbelts and texting and driving when you're too tired and topics like that. And then tell my personal story, because at the age of 25, I lost my ability to walk in a car crash as a result of a couple split-second decisions that had enormous life-changing consequences. And I had very severe lung damage and ended up paralyzed from the lower chest down for life. So I feel that my story is a cautionary tale for young people. And we know they feel invincible at that age. And also their prefrontal cortex isn't fully developed till around the age of 25. So they don't want to have what it takes neurobiologically yet to make the best decision. So that's one topic that I have probably spoke about the most. Certainly in the beginning, that's what I spoke about all the time. And then I also do, after I received a master's degree in disability studies and I got a master's in psychology, I switched and started adding disability awareness presentations, like at conferences, where I talk about things like ableism and stigma and different types of disabilities and my experience as someone with a disability, just dealing with strangers, and that becomes comedy hour. But and so disability law and policy, so like the ADA and the Air Carrier Access Act, and we have a plethora of disability rights laws in the United States. So I can do a presentation on that. And once in a while I do accessible travel, because after my spinal cord injury, I was a travel agent for 9 years. And then my husband got stationed in Germany. He's in the Army, and he was in the Army. And so it was easy to get to a lot of places because those countries are small, and where we were stationed was pretty much right smack in the middle of Europe. So I had this goal of getting to 50 countries by age 50, and I'm a wheelchair user. So, I mean, I went to 50 countries as a wheelchair user, and with the travel agent experience, plus I've been to 49 states. A lot of that was work-related, speaking and moving around with the Army. But with all that travel and planning, I'm able to speak on accessible travel and how the laws apply to the different travel and tourism sectors.
That's cool. That's very exciting, Kelly. Man, that's a lot. That is so exciting. 50 countries, and you did it.
Yeah, I had to get sixth continent in real quick. I was like, there was a group trip down to Chile, and I went down. I asked my husband if he wanted to go to Chile. He said, no, you go. I'm like, okay. So I went by myself and met a group down there that I hadn't met. I was like, I got to get the sixth continent in. And then we don't need to talk about Antarctica, because unless somebody else wants to pay for it, I'm not going.
That's fair. That's fair. What's the one state you haven't been to?
So Hawaii.
Okay. I got it. Okay. That's it. Okay. All right. I feel like the 25 thing is a perfect kind of setup for, so let's kind of rewind the clock in your life, so to speak, Kelly. Let's go back and put you in sort of your high school body. Are you planning on becoming a professional speaker? Like, I mean, I guess obviously not. Where are you going to go to college? Are you going to be an accountant? Like, what does your world look like? And what are people telling you? Like, what are the external influences happening?
So my parents always pushed college. Like, it was just understood, you're going to go. And I thought that I kind of had to, even though I wasn't big on being told what to do. I just kind of had it in my head that that's what you have to do. So I had planned on going, and I did end up eventually, you know, getting my bachelor's degree in health and exercise science. But in high school, I was a little bit of a train wreck, emotionally dysregulated. I mean, I was in honors classes, but emotionally immature. I struggled a lot with sleep patterns and mood. And we didn't know it then, but I had undiagnosed bipolar 1 disorder. So pretty serious. My parents just thought I was rebellious and out of control, but it was difficult. It was a difficult time. And my parents couldn't figure out why I would sleep all the time, and then I'd be not sleeping. So I like at all. So I wouldn't be able to, you know, I'd like quit. I'd start volleyball and I'd be fine. And then I'd quit because I was too tired and or track. I mean, I just kept happening. So high school was tough.
So like almost like a chronic insomnia sort of a thing?
That's part of it is when you're manic or hypomanic, which is a mild, much milder form, but I mean, still, it's a lower form of mania, but you don't sleep. Like, you don't sleep nearly as much. But when you're in a depressive state, you're going to sleep a lot more. And it's not a dichotomy, like you're either up or down. I mean, it kind of just can go all over the place, but there you do have the extremes.
So can you do me a favor? Because I think we were talking about this a little bit before, and ironically, I used the word manic, and I'm worried even now, it's perfect timing, that I used it incorrectly. So can you kind of, for the sake of diving a little bit deeper, what is manic? What is mania?
So
by definition,
mania is when you are, for people with bipolar disorder, like when you're truly manic or mania, you have very extreme symptoms and impulsive behavior. And if you have what's called psychotic features with it, you are delusional and you hallucinate. I had that happen a couple times in college, which makes for some interesting stories. So, but that was just because the stress and the no sleep triggered my brain chemistry into full-blown mania with psychotic features. But you end up with reckless behavior and no sleep and pressured speech. When I say reckless behavior, also people go on spending sprees and gamble too much, and the reckless driving and sometimes promiscuity and the just out of character behavior. And it makes people do things they normally wouldn't do in their right mind. And it's not their fault that they're having mania, right? And then, but you said it in a way that, you know how people say, oh, she's so OCD. But the person really doesn't have OCD. They're just maybe really organized. And it kind of makes light of what can be a debilitating disorder. It's the same thing when someone gets called bipolar. I'm like, up to 20% of people with bipolar disorder die by suicide. And 50% make at least one attempt on their life. And if you look at the general population, it's way, way less than 1% that die by suicide. So it's very serious. So when someone calls someone bipolar, you know, I frown upon that a little bit because it's debilitating. I can tell you right now, if I had a choice, if someone said you can get rid of the bipolar disorder or the spinal cord injury, meaning you can't walk, I would, without thinking about it, get rid of the bipolar disorder. That's how disabling it can be. So I went all over the place. I'm sorry. You only asked about mania.
No, thank you. So I mean, that is. So let's talk about bipolar. Let's talk about this. And let's talk about the, you mentioned, oh man, I wish I could remember the word in this moment, but I think you mentioned a sort of schizophrenic component to bipolar that can cause for hallucinations.
Psychotic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. I knew I used the wrong word. Okay. So tell me about like what, so, okay. So you hit a spurt. And I would be interested in hearing, like, does something trigger the spurt, or, and you, then you're not getting sleep like you should, sort of an insomnia thing. And that's naturally going to, it's probably become self-serving because I'm just trying to understand. That's more stress that then is more, and then you get to a point to where you've had so little sleep over so long that you'll hallucinate. And meanwhile, the rest of the world is telling you, you're just a rebellious teen. Knock it off.
Right. I didn't have any psychotic features in high school.
Okay.
That didn't happen. But I did have my first, I had such strong suicidal ideations that I did act on them at age 17. So I was a senior. But it wasn't as serious of an attempt that happened later in my 20s. But the mania with psychotic features, like, I don't like to use the word crazy because it stigmatizes people that have mental health disabilities that, you know, they can't help it. So I don't use that word, but there was a time where I would definitely be, you know, the poster child for crazy. There was a short period of time in college. And so, like, for instance, and the stress, I was under a tremendous amount of stress and getting no sleep. So I was working at one point three jobs with a full load of school, and most of the time two jobs with a full load of school. And they had some family problems going on. And then I don't know exactly how it manifested, but I do remember the mania. And I think it went on for a few weeks, a couple weeks at least, where I wasn't in reality. I remember being at the gas station in St. Joe, Missouri, where I'm from, and thinking that people were leaving because I was there. I was paranoid. And I remember thinking that I was supposed to sing on the radio. So I left. I was sitting with my aunt and uncle at a bar that my dad owned, and I thought I was supposed to go sing on the radio. And so I took off my shoes and ran barefoot down the street to go to the radio. And so, I mean, this is like mania with psychotic features. This was some, thinking back, I did things like that. I got up and started teaching the class my senior year in college, and campus security was called, and they didn't put me in handcuffs or anything. They were super empathetic. And my teachers, who I'd had for, they knew me, and they knew I was sick, and they knew it wasn't my fault. And I was actually told much later by one of my classmates that her mom had told her it's like diabetes. She can't help it. You know, she just has an illness, which I didn't understand at the time. But I had to go to the psychiatric floor of the hospital for a little while when all of that happened. And there were things like that. I remember getting the mail and it was torn. And I called my mom because she was a postmaster. And I'm like, are you in on this conspiracy? You're opening my mail, things like that. So that's not been my whole life. I'm 52. And that was like this isolated, I want to say few months. And it was a couple weeks. And then a second time later that semester, I feel like it was all within one semester of college that all this mania with psychotic features happened.
Interesting. Yeah. So in the main, your network at the time is actually relatively supportive, maybe even aware of something that you weren't quite yet. Is that fair to say?
So no, nobody knew what was wrong, including my family. And when I went to the hospital, I was there a while and they said I had bipolar disorder. And I said, no, you know how when you break your leg and they take an x-ray and then they say your leg's broken. I'm like, you can't take a picture of my brain. You can't judge me. You know, I looked at it like, no, you don't know. You can't label me like that. And I refused to believe that. And it was formerly called manic depression. For the people, that's the older term. But I just denied that for a while, for years.
What brought about accepting it?
So after I graduated from college, I moved to California, to Santa Barbara, where my friend was living. And I was in a terrible car crash and ended up paralyzed. And actually, in retrospect, I didn't know this for a while, but in retrospect, I feel like I was hypomanic that day, so reckless behavior. As I think back to the way I was driving, no seatbelt, that wasn't a good idea either, on a curvy mountain road and a Jeep Wrangler. But anyway, I didn't do well with it. As somebody that I had low self-worth besides these other issues, and I didn't do well with the being paralyzed in the first year and a half at all. And then I had a family member hurt me, like physically hurt me. And so I was trapped on the floor. I couldn't get up. And so once another family member helped me up, I snuck in the bathroom and took 3 bottles of pills, about 80 pills. And part of me wanted to die. Like, so I took all the pills and laid down. And when I woke up, I saw people in the room. And I think that was because of the pills, not because of anything else. But the funny thing is, when I was taken to the hospital, because I was seeing people in the room, I said, get those people out of here. They started asking me questions when they were checking me in the hospital. And they said, are you suicidal? And it's like, well, I might as well tell you now, because it didn't work. And I told them about the pills. A couple of family members checked to verify, and nothing happened to me. All of those pills went through my system, all 3 bottles, and nothing happened. I didn't get sick. No symptoms. No. So then I was like, okay, I guess I'm supposed to be here. That was my feeling. And I've never, ever shared this in a public way. So I just wanted to tell you that I'm just getting into some things that I'm ready to talk about in the hopes that other people, anybody hearing this, might not be afraid to reach out for help.
Yeah. So for anybody listening and not watching, I'm bawling my eyes out because I'm appreciative of you sharing on another level, because this is something people struggle with, and it's not something we talk about, but we need to. So, you decide you need to be here. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? What were your feelings about nothing happening. I mean, so I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm going to be honest to say, I would be upset. I would be disappointed, is what I would probably be feeling if I had the resolve to go through something like that and I didn't get what I wanted.
The thing is, we have a natural survival instinct. So only part of me wanted to die. Obviously, part of me wanted to live because I went on. And there hasn't been another, I mean, I was 26, so I'm 52 now. There's not been another suicide attempt since then. So
it's beautiful.
I was, just felt like I was supposed to be here. Like I just, and I was believed in a higher power, but I was raised Catholic, but I would not have considered myself a religious person at all at the time. But I just still felt like I was supposed to be here. And I didn't think a whole lot about it. It was just like, okay, fine. But I spent a month in the hospital, the psychiatric hospital, and they put me on some pills. And I've never had, I've definitely had mood swings and a midlife crisis, but nothing like that to that level since then.
Well, and I did want to ask, but I didn't want to betray your feelings if you felt like it might have been a bit of a miracle, so to speak, that nothing did happen.
I think there's a significant possibility, yes.
So I want to hear about the hospital. Was that an integral part of you understanding what it is you're going through?
Yes. Yes, that was the point, because that's what you asked me about, is when I accepted it, and I forgot to mention that. So when I was in the hospital, my stepmom at the time brought me a book, and I don't remember what it was called, but it was by Patty Duke. She had bipolar disorder, and I read her experiences, and I was like, oh my gosh, I have this. And that's when I knew, when I was 26. After that, I figured out, but from then on, I didn't talk about it because of stigma, but that I knew I could admit that I had it. I could admit it to myself. I didn't talk to other people about it, except close friends knew, of course, and close family members. But that it was that book, and that I accepted it. And as far as in the hospital, I met a lot of interesting people. I met a guy that had schizophrenia, and he spoke 5 languages. He was brilliant. He couldn't help it. I mean, I remember meeting a lot of people in there, and the psychiatrist I had, I was newly paralyzed. So I'd been paralyzed 9 months or so. And then I had this I was dealing with, and I lost everything because I was a restaurant server in Santa Barbara. And I couldn't go back to my place there. I was up steps. And I asked the psychiatrist, I was laying in bed and he was talking to me. And he said, people were complaining because I didn't have to go to the group. Like I would skip group in the mornings. And I asked him, if you were all of a sudden poor, you had nothing and paralyzed from the chest down, wouldn't you want to die? And he said, yes. And he didn't make me go to group in the mornings. He knew I wanted to sleep. He let me sleep in, and everyone else was aggravated that Kelly had the special treatment. But I just remember little things like that.
I have this burning question, and I figured out how to ask it. And we don't have to talk about it any more than you want to, but why would anybody hurt you? Why would that happen? And I don't know why I'm asking it like that, because the question might be, how did they hurt you? But that's not as important to me.
So
as why?
When you're paralyzed, you don't have a spinal cord injury, you don't have bowel and bladder control. And that's actually probably most people would say that's the hardest thing about it, is getting on that schedule and figuring your body out. But in the beginning, you don't know it. So you have accidents, you haven't figured it out. And I eventually got a surgery, so I don't have, I did a couple of years later, I had no accidents. But you don't have that, your central nervous system, the message you can't get from your bladder or your bowels to say it's time to go. So it's all on a schedule. Anyway, my bladder was really small and spastic. And so even if I catheterized, that's what it's called, that's what you do, it leaked. My bladder leaked, and I had peed the bed or whatever. I don't know how to say it in a classy way. And the family member was angry with me for doing that. And so, yeah, like was physical and pulled my wheelchair backwards and I fell out of it. And then another family member came in and told me I was being irrational and, you know, did something I can't even speak about on a podcast. It would be too upsetting to you too. But I would just say, I don't know, like a anger issue, anger, unresolved issue. I don't know, personality disorder. I don't really know what that family member's problem was with, I think maybe unresolved issues of their own.
So, yeah. Thank you for sharing, Kelly. I need to take a moment.
Okay.
And thank you. So you're in the hospital. You're taking all that into a ward, and you have a psychiatrist that it sounds like is the helpful because they're sympathetic to the difficulty. And you said newly paralyzed. That's a lot at once. But then fortunately, you're also reading the book that's helping you to kind of understand this is what I have is bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And you're taking that into the ward, yes, with you, the knowledge that this is what I have with a psychiatrist that's sympathetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read it there while I was in there, but yes.
Say that again.
I read the book while I was in there, but yes, that's right.
Okay. So I'm hearing it sounds like a lot of healing all at once. Is that fair in the ward? Can you tell me about that?
I guess I don't think of it that way, but yes, that was a profound moment to figure out that's, you know, to accept that diagnosis. I would say
one is that mm-hmm. don't let me betray is how do you think of it? If healing's not the right word, I'm just thinking of it like for me, that's maybe how I would view it for me.
I didn't feel good at all. I mean, I was so indescribably depressed. So I don't think of it as a healing environment. I feel like it was safer than being at my family member's house at the time. But it was good because they started trying medications, which I eventually became compliant. And that's life-changing to take the medication you need because some people just need true pharmaceuticals, despite what some say. You know, the natural things don't. We have to go with synthetic drugs sometimes, cost benefit analysis. But anyway, they were able to start, you know, experimenting and all that. And it was, I guess, a positive turning point, but it was a very, very difficult time.
So I want to ask about, and this is another weird one, I'm not sure, but you've described a scenario where like, so when one is taking pharmaceuticals and it's life-changing and it's helpful, but then you stop, I could see a potential where you're back in that sort of, I don't even know what to call it, state of rebellion, that for lack of any better word, I'm sure you have a better one, where it's like, no, I don't need that. I'm better now.
Yes. Well, they gave me pills that caused me to gain, some of them have side effects. One of them caused me to gain about 50 pounds. Quickly. And so I was very vain. I still am, actually. I just kind of consider it as something I accept. It's kind of a value neutral trait, not negative. It just is what it is. I was pretty vain. So back then I was like, I'd rather be crazy than fat. And, you know, that's not very nice, but that was my view back then. So I refused to take them and I quit it. And we're talking about 1999. So in 2004, I eventually started taking one little white pill every day. It was completely life-changing. It's kind of a brand new drug, miracle pill, but, you know, I went and got some help later, you know, obviously a few years later. And so for 21 years, every day, just little white pill changed everything, which, you know, after I started that pill, I mean, or after the psych ward, I ended up getting a boyfriend, getting a car, getting a job and all that. And then slowly getting some confidence and all that. And then in 04 started the little white pill because I went to therapy. I decided to go to therapy. I was having boy problems and problems dealing with strangers, which is an interesting topic. I was having trouble with people asking me if I needed help all the time because I'm an 8 on the Enneagram, for those that know what Enneagram is. And that's a challenger. And the last thing they want to be seen as is dependent. And that didn't match my new physicality. So people were coming up and going, do you need any help all the time? It was driving me a little nuts. And anyway, so I went to therapy over that. And the therapist was amazing. And also sent me to a really good psychiatrist. And he said, there's this new pill that's working wonders for people. And I told him my story. And he's like, I don't know how you graduated from college unmedicated. But anyway, I started Lamictal. And so that was 21 years ago. And since then, because of that little pill, you know, I got married. I've been married 19 years and got 2 master's degrees and 2 advanced certifications and fell into a public speaking career. And I don't think any of that would have been possible without the little white pill. And this is just an important part of our discussion because there's probably somebody watching that either has a family member with this or with clinical depression, certainly, which is the most disabling condition in the world, and just doesn't want to get the help because of internalized stigma or societal stigma. So that's why I want to talk about the so important to take, ask for help and to take the pill if you need it.
Yeah. It's interesting. What helped change my thinking, there's a book by Jonathan Haidt called The Happiness Hypothesis. And I hope I don't betray the book, but I think I've got it pretty close. He has a section where he calls, you know, winning the cortical lottery is what he calls it. And he's like, there's different people, probably, I think he's describing me, that have higher cortisol levels. And so for them, you know, it's the typical glasses off, wall half full, roses and daisies. And he's like, for the rest of us, it's Prozac, is what he says in the book. And he's like, for those of you that don't like medication, you could try some sort of daily meditative regimen, maybe, and a lot of hard work. But also, I don't know why you would work so hard when there's Prozac. And it was probably the first time for me, because I'll open up to being the type of person that was like, you know, you can get by without medication. I don't understand the point. Everybody's life is hard. That chapter of that book or that excerpt that I'm was probably the first time of like, no, that's not how the brain works. And he does a really, really, really good job of giving examples and analogies where deformed brains and different brains almost predict outcomes. He gives an example of a person with a tumor pushing on the prefrontal cortex that forces an action, and then he goes to prison, and then they remove it. They find it, and they remove it. And then it later comes back and it puts him back in prison. And I'm not getting that perfect, but I'm not on purpose. I apologize. I'm not sure exactly what the question there is, but it really is interesting because I agree with you that it's like some people have barriers, diagnosis, right? And this is to help with that.
They have a serious mental disorder. Yes, some people need medication. You won the cortical lottery. That's, yeah, I did not. So I have to have a little white pill. You probably can get by with meditation. Maybe something happened that was really, really severe. I mean, let's just say loss of, a family member or something.
Yeah.
A lot of stress. You may take a Prozac short term or Zoloft or another SSRI, but you wouldn't need it long term probably. But I have what's called high negative affect, which the happiness researcher Arthur Brooks talks about a lot of this. And so basically my set point is way lower than yours, like natural happiness level. I mean, mine, I would argue, is at least bottom 5%, probably bottom 1%, looking at bipolar stats, certainly bottom 5%. So that's why I was telling my brother last night at dinner, like he was in town from Florida, and I was like, that's why I've always chased highs, whether it's, you know, skydiving or, you know, just I've always just, it's taken a lot to excite me, to move, you know, get my mood up.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I wrote down the book because I'm curious. But yes, I know exactly what you mean. We have theoretically a set point, which is 40 to 60% or so of your happiness, and then everything else is kind of external things, like a little bit. This, you know, do you have purpose and meaning in your life? Family, friends, good connections. You know, some people would argue faith. It depends on which happiness research you're talking to. But money means, the research shows us money is very little part of it. It's not nearly as big as we would think as Americans. After your basic needs are met, it kind of just
diminishing returns. To expand further, I had this weird experience a few months ago, and I call it a blessing because I got sick, and what I could tell, it lowered the set points drastically because I went into this like cyclical anxiety, and it manifested physically, and there was depression where normally I may not be depressed. And the example I give is there was at one point where I'm waiting to do like a telehealth, and the woman, then it's a circle screen, and I'm waiting to talk to the woman. I assume it's a woman based off the name. And I'm over here like, oh my goodness, I'm so paranoid about what I'm wearing and where the phone should be. Should the phone be in front of me? Should the phone be on the desk? And this is meanwhile, I do these things like this podcast and these meetings with business owners and these, you know, presentations. I am like going into a spiral over the fact that I have a hoodie on and I'm not sure if that's what I should be wearing or not. And it really was a blessing in disguise because it opened up a world for me to see what it might be like on the other side.
People in the psychology space will now correct you. What used to be called the body-brain connection, they say, no, it's all one. Mental health is not separate from physical health. It's all one. They don't even look at it as a connection anymore. So yes, that's just adding a caveat to what you're saying.
So I'm not expecting you to know the answer to this, but it is a shared question. I feel like it's the one we have to get into. How do we as a society put ourselves in other people's shoes when we're literally incapable of that? Like I had this experience of some wild ailment that ruined my set points. And at the time it was very, very difficult, but I am sincerely pleased. Because I remember coming out of it and talking to friends and being like, dude, you know, is this what you've been talking about? Because I'm there. Like, and I have, I feel for you.
So you feel for people with mental health struggles now, a generalized anxiety disorder, maybe, or clinical depression. Is that what you're saying because of what happened to you?
When I had felt for him in general anyway, but I think it was the first time that I really felt like I got to live in their body for about two. It lasted a week or two. And it was significant. I mean, I didn't know if I was going to come out of it. And there was a part of it that was psychosomatic. There was a recurring fever at night that was very detrimental. And anyway, it's a long thing, and I don't need to get into all of it, but the point was, it gave me an opportunity to experience perhaps a piece of what people with mental disorders, like what you're describing, are going through, like what you might be going through. For those that haven't had that experience,
well,
how
that was temporary, but
well, right, but how do we get in those shoes? How do we understand in a way that we can help each other?
I feel like it's part of maturity. The more things we go through, maybe most people become more empathetic. I know the last 3 years I've become way, 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 way less judgmental of others. You don't know someone's journey, their experiences, their upbringing, their wiring, their brain chemistry. You don't know. And so you can't say what you would do in a particular situation. And so I am not judgmental about hardly anything. It'd have to be just super malicious behavior that's just unspeakable for me to really be judgmental about it, what you're talking about. But that came with a lot of trauma. And well, you were sick, so you went through something hard, and that's when you developed empathy. The same way, I guess, when I sustained a spinal cord injury and I became paralyzed, and I had kind of an aha moment in ICU. I was laying in bed, and I was in ICU for a month. I don't remember exactly when this was, but it was definitely an aha moment. And I was laying there, and I remember thinking, oh, they're the same as me. And when I say they, I mean people that use wheelchairs for mobility, because I had thought of them as inherently different than me in some way. And since I was now, I hadn't seen a wheelchair yet. I just heard I was going to be using one to get around. But it hit me like, oh, they're the same, because I became one of them in a split second, right? So what happened is I went into ICU, well, I guess the day that my body flew into the backseat of the Jeep and I broke my spinal cord. I guess that's for the moment, technically. But I switched from having all this social currency to having this very, consider a severe disability. And I didn't know what discrimination was at all. I didn't know what it was like to be patronized or pitied or talked down to or, in any at all. I mean, had no idea. And so that forced me to develop empathy for historically marginalized, stigmatized groups. For sure. And I'm just sharing, like, how do we all, I'm kind of thinking out loud, because I think that maybe you, in some way, that one way that you develop empathy for others is going through hard stuff yourself.
One, do you think a part of it too might be in the question, do you think it's possible as a society we unnecessarily demonize mind-altering substances, not just prescription drugs, but even non-prescriptions? And I really need to be careful in saying that, because I'm not proposing some sort of free-for-all. I'm more saying that, is it possible that if we were more open to that notion in general, people would be more open to experimenting with things that might give them a glimpse into how other people think?
I don't think I understand the question.
Okay. No. And I'm trying to think how to reframe it.
For people to go through a certain type of experience in order to develop empathy for others, but I don't know exactly what experience you mean.
Well, let me ask it like this. Is it safe to say you didn't, I mean, this was the point you were making, one little white drug taken daily, medication prescribed. You didn't know that world until that point. Is that safe to say? Maybe you fantasized about it, but you had no clue what it looked like to live it.
I think that I knew what it was like to be mentally ill before then, because I was in the psych hospital. I had to go for a few days, then I had to go for a month. And then in college, I told you, I got up and...
Yes.
People knew.
But you didn't...
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. The question is, you didn't know... Did you know what it... And maybe you did, because I don't... Did you know what it meant to feel well, to not feel like that?
Oh, yes. Yes. Okay. When I was a little girl, I felt fine. And then from time to time, I didn't really understand, because bipolar was my normal. That's every day, day in, day out. So I don't know. But there were times where I was very functional. I got up every day and went to school and hung out with my friends and did things. But I mean, there were times where you just get through it. I don't know. Really no such thing as normal, but
No, I agree. I apologize. So to get back to the root of the question, and it's an interesting question. We can move past it, I guess. I don't think there's an answer per se, but I'm trying to, you know, with obviously people think differently, right? You know, there's people going through different things, and all we have is the bias of the experiences we've lived. I think you make a really good point that, you know, the more difficulty you go through as a person, the more you develop empathy. But I'm also over here trying to, maybe it's the eternal optimist. I'm trying to, like, what's a world where people that haven't been through as much difficulty and hopefully won't can still develop a degree of empathy?
I think it starts with the basics. Like, is it important to a person to try their best every day to be a good person, right? And part of being a good person is having love for others. And part of having love for others is having acceptance and empathy. It's kind of the back to the basics, if you think about it.
So, okay, jumping ahead in your journey a little bit, how do we get from... Oh, man, though, it reminds me of another question. So you mentioned an interesting thing. You came out of the hospital. You said you were, and I might be have my timeline off, but if I recall, you said you then started a regular cadence of medication and you got your confidence back.
I didn't take medication until 2004. So from 1999 to 2004, okay. I just lived life unmedicated.
Okay. And the season of you getting your confidence back, was that after that?
Well, I was a lot more accomplished and clear.
Okay.
And all yes. More accomplished after I started taking the pill.
Yes.
and you know, making sense and less symptoms for sure. Before that, I got confidence from my therapist in my early 30s, so we're talking the year early 2000s, had me read The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem by Nathaniel Brandon. It's one of the most important books I've ever read. But what I took away from that was, you know, quit whining about your childhood and you do good things and then you feel good about yourself and that raises your self-esteem. So that was kind of my mantra back then is... You do the best you can every day to adhere, you know, live according to your values. I might not have had the words for it then. Adhere to your values and you end up doing well and have it. Yeah, that's what kind of gave me the confidence. Going back to work without moving or feeling two-thirds of your body, going back to work full time and all that and driving again and getting back, that gave me confidence is just doing those things. It was really important to be independent. So getting the independence back.
So you mentioned having difficulty with strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a public speaker.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that journey.
That's a 5-hour conversation. So it's fascinating the things people assume. People make a lot of assumptions about you when you have a visible and moderate to severe disability, people make assumptions, you know, about your abilities, about your sexuality, about your socioeconomic status, all kinds of things. People assume people make all sorts of assumptions, but they'll just make comments. What they do, a lot of people tend, not everybody, especially young people, they don't do it as much. They're so accepting of human variation, Gen Z, that you just, younger people, you don't see it as much, but they tend to make wheelchair user my master status. They make it relevant. And so if it's somebody that doesn't know me at all, it's going to be, yeah, that's my master status before person, woman, wife, army wife, volunteer, public speaker, friend, sister, all the other things that I am. So they'll have to comment on it. The other day I was going to get my nails done and I was getting out of the car and I saw a guy that was like 100. I mean, he wasn't 100, but he's, you know, 85, 90. I don't know. He's very old. I could tell. He was standing close to my car and I'm like, oh no, just get ready. So I was in rural Kansas. Get ready. It's coming. Be nice. Be nice. Getting a comment, you know, about either the wheelchair or the disability. And I was right, because I can usually call it. And he goes, you need a motor for that thing. I knew that he couldn't just say, gosh, it's hot out, because it was 1,000 degrees. You know, why can't we just say, you know, talk about something else? But I knew he was going to have to talk about it. And he did. I was right. And I just said, have a good afternoon, sir. You know, I just didn't really engage, kind of ignored that. And then, you know, in the bathroom at a restaurant in my hometown not long ago is another example. I was going in the stall and somebody's like, do you need any help? I turned around. I said, I'm just going to pretend like you didn't ask me that. But another bathroom in my hometown restaurant not long ago, this woman goes, a stranger just comes up to me and goes, my husband's in a wheelchair. I said, my husband can walk. And then she's like, she goes, how long have you been like that? I go, like what? She said, disabled. And I said, I'm not legally disabled. The Social Security Administration defines it as not able to work. And I work. And they would laugh at me if I applied for disability check. I was just kind of jacking with her. Because under the Americans with Disabilities Act, I do have a disability and then societal definition, right? But I was just kind of jacking with her. That sort of stuff goes on day in and day out and has for 20, Saturday was 27 years. So some of it, people say, well, they don't mean anything by it. It depends on the comment. It still comes from a deep-seated place of a feeling of superiority a lot of the time, or from a preconceived notion, or from pity. Doesn't usually come from a wonderful place. Even altruism, we can argue, that's an interesting discussion. Altruism, I believe, it, you know, you could argue it's selfish. You're trying to make yourself feel good. And some people love to use me as an object to do so. Oh, wheelchair user, there's my chance to do a good deed for the day. But I mean, that's a more complicated conversation, that part. But it just depends. It gets a little old, not blending into a crowd and always has to be relevant and always have to, you know, you would think that not being able to go anywhere with stairs would be the big deal, or not hiking anymore is the big deal, or having to have a bathroom schedule is the big deal. Dealing with strangers and that kind of stuff, ableism, that stuff is actually harder for me.
So, all right, I've got a couple now, and these come from a selfish place that hopefully help me. So does it bug you when people offer help?
Unsolicited offers of assistance. I never got those before my spinal cord injury. If somebody able-bodied asks me if I need help, I mean, I'm so used to it. I just say no, thank you, and I handle it better than I did in the beginning. I used to go, yeah, I need some money. You know, I would just smile and go, yeah, I need some money. Because I'm not going to be out in public putting my wheelchair together and, you know, living life. I'm not going to be, why would I need help, you know? So unless someone's bleeding, crying, struggling, they're on the ground, why would they need to? Just because I use a wheelchair for mobility instead of my legs? It's kind of my thought.
Interesting. So the second question, and again, I was raised, you know, go and help that person, right? And so I go and I offer help. Now, the examples I'm giving aren't specifically applicable to wheelchair. I think I just, in my mind, naturally, it's normally like, you know, hold the door for an older couple or something like that, right? And so I'll naturally, and I actually feel bad sometimes if I see somebody and I didn't go hold the door for them or whatever. The second question is kind of, I feel like as a society in the main, sometimes we don't ask for help when we need it because, and this isn't on you, obviously, I'm almost trying to create a universal rule of thumb for myself. That's what I'm trying to do. Mm-hmm. Like the difference between the person that clearly does need help, but was afraid to ask for it, and then I offer, and it isn't, versus the person that's like, no, I can take care of myself. And I'm a little annoyed that you asked.
Well, the door thing is different. If someone's got a severe mobility impairment, and it's obvious they have a cane or a walker, or they're older, and you're right there by the door. I mean, it's just kind of obvious, common sense thing. What's mean is if I open the door for somebody, they are really confused. They don't want to walk through. They don't know what to do with that if I open the door for somebody. But anyway, like I said, unless someone's...
I love this, by the way. I'm just really enjoying the... Because I don't know. I could see a little bit of me in some of that.
It
just
makes
like, how are they going
to... It makes you want to follow me around for the day, doesn't it? And just, you know...
I bet you're a little bit of a comedian. On some end too, right? Is it safe to say you probably got a little bit of comedy in some of these sort of stuff?
Safety briefing, I can get funny. Like it's kind of like I don't mean to. If I go in and talk at the Young Traffic Offenders Program, it's a court appointed place where 20-year-olds go and when they have speeding tickets in and they'll come out and go, "You're so funny." And I'm like, it's not supposed to be funny. But no, the jokes about dealing with strangers, I'll tell a couple at the end, but when I'm talking about post-SCI, spinal cord injury life, but I kind of got off track as far as the help thing. Yeah, most people want to live as independently as possible, right? And it's with, but there are people that are afraid to ask, but they need the help. That's going to be kind of an obvious situation. Like if I'm like looking at, for instance, somebody that uses a wheelchair is a, you know, they're looking at an item high up at a shelf, like grocery store, and you notice that. You might ask, that would be. But if they're just sitting there on their cell phone outside, you don't need to go and interrupt their conversation, ask them if they need help, because that's happened to me before, just because I am sitting in a wheelchair. So does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And I mean, I think it's the answer. It's the nuance that, you know, it's the answer when there's nuance, right? It's what you're saying is, you know, if there's a clear struggle, then yeah, obviously offer to help. But if you, Kelly, you're going to the stall, you look like you know what you're doing, last thing you want to hear is, can I help you?
That's right. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. How did you first get involved with public speaking?
Sort of an accident that it got big. But my a girl I heard about who served a kind of as a mentor way back, like 2000, she spoke for an organization called Think First, which I speak for them sometimes now. It's a brain and spinal cord injury prevention program. It's national, started by neurosurgeons in the 80s. And I went to listen to her speak nearby, and it was amazing. And she told her personal story, and she was paralyzed and had her seatbelt on in a car crash. And I just thought she was amazing. And she's like, "Do you want to do this?" I'm like, "No, no." And I was scared of the public speaking. And but I was intrigued. Then I started with 5 minutes and found it cathartic to tell high schoolers, "Hey, you know, prioritize personal safety. Take this stuff seriously. Because thousands and thousands and thousands of people get severe injuries, catastrophic injuries, and acquire severe disabilities as a result of car crashes, right? And then we have, it varies year to year, but around 40,000 people die every year in car crashes. So anyway, I started way back when and did that on the side while I was a travel agent, did that on the side here and there. And got, you get paid just a little bit by this foundation. And then in 2005, I moved to North Carolina. I met an Army officer and we ended up getting married the next year, but there was no Think First Foundation out there. So I started volunteering for the Army and speaking a lot in 2005, 2006. And I'd go and do several safety briefings for, it was usually majors, lieutenant colonels, and colonels for their units. And then basically I got a call in 2009 from somebody that was a battalion commander. When I say battalion, he's in charge of somewhere between 500 and 800 people in the Army. And then he was a brigade commander somewhere else. So he was in charge of 5,000. Basically what happened is the leaders became bigger and he called and he said, we want you to come out here and speak, safety, and I said, okay, just fly me out to Kentucky, you know? So he insisted on paying me and this was in 2009 and I didn't know what to do about that. And I just threw a number out and he goes, no. And he said, what would you charge like a company like IBM? And so I didn't know about speaking fees and how that worked. But I started getting paid in 2009 and it was like a domino effect. And then leaders at that particular military base, which was Fort Campbell, Kentucky, they flew me out 9 times to do 9 different. And this is thousands of soldiers, right? And it just grew and grew and grew. And then, you know, the next year I was speaking at Fort Lee, Virginia, and they said, you're not charging enough. And I said, fine, double it. And then I started, you know, just speaking all over the place. And then it got so big that I had a lot of references and things and I could just go to people and go, hi, I'd like to go to Alaska and speak. And then they're like, okay. And they had me come up and do it and paid me well to do so. So I just kind of was an accident and it was amazing. It just, so I left my travel agent job and then, eventually after the, you know, more education, I started diving into the disability awareness world, which is harder to, I want more presentations about the disability element of diversity. I think it's lacking that awareness, that education. But I don't get nearly as many calls to do that, but I get to do it sometimes. So that's kind of what happened. Yeah.
Looking back, what do you think of all this? I mean, I know that's a weird question. I don't ask it, haven't really, but it's just, it's a story. It's a ride. And you know, it, like you said, some of the speaking kind of on accident, almost fortuitous or whatever you want to call it. What do you think about it all?
Well, I was very fortunate to be the right place, the right time several times because my husband was an Army leader. And so I was in these places to meet Army leaders. I mean, the commander of the 82nd Airborne Division in, I don't know, 06 or 07 said, find the girl in the wheelchair, the blonde-headed girl in the wheelchair. I want her to speak at such and such conference. That was one of his colonels like tasked to do. And there were 58,000 soldiers on Fort Bragg, not to mention family members and not to mention government civilians working there. So it was funny. But that sort of thing happened. And then many years later, actually just a few years ago, the general at West Point's like, get her in here. But he was back then. Well, actually, it was like 2012. I'd already done quite a bit by then, but I'd spoken to his unit. And then he was, you know, in charge of West Point and he, had me come out and then come out again. And so basically when you, that kind of worked out, that whole do the best you can every day, it all works out. Your chances of it working out are exponentially higher. I don't believe it works out for everybody that does the best they can every day. It's just, what do they say? Luck is when preparation meets opportunity. So I was prepared and the opportunity was there.
It's beautiful. So we have a couple standard questions for wrap up, but before we move into wrap up, is there anything I missed?
Oh, I don't think so. We've covered a lot about me.
Yeah, such a beautiful story, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you. It's got me really thinking about just how I don't know. Important, maybe it is to reflect once in a while. All of us, not just me, because I don't think about this, the past, this deeply. So I think everybody should look back at their experiences, good and bad, and how it shaped them. It might be good part of a gratitude practice, which they've shown research shows to be really good for resilience.
Yeah. Yeah. So the questions are, we have a motto over here that goes, if we've seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant in your life, Kelly, that you'd like to pay homage to in this moment?
Oh, so can it just be a family member or something like that, or a friend? Does it have to be?
I think for the sake of everyone, it's just kind of the first person that came to your mind in this moment.
I was thinking you're looking for some like super wise celebrity or something.
Mm-hmm. No. Just someone that has helped you to where you're at today that you want to pay respects to in this moment.
There's kind of two that come to mind. But my grandmother, my late grandmother, she was like so wonderful, unconditional love. I don't know where I'd be without her. My cousins would say the same thing. Like, we totally all won the grandparent lottery. I can't just tell you how good she was and accepting. And through all that bipolar train wreckness, like, she was around for all of it and just watched me unravel and then watched me get paralyzed and was so loving and accepting despite all of that, and always, always made me believe that I was smart. I think when you believe that, or believe that you're talented or whatever, it's, if you have that inherent belief, you're going to go further, right? And so, and then Dr. Michelle Gibler, she's used to be in charge of the Columbia chapter, the Missouri chapter of Think First. She kept like flying me to conferences and just making me feel like I was this really good speaker. And I didn't think so at the time. And we're talking like 2002, 2003, 2004. But she made me feel really, really good about myself. And she's retired now, but I don't think I would have gone on to just speak all the time for the Army and offer to do so and be so confident in that military world. Without her pushing me. She doesn't know that.
The second question is, if you had kind of a pithy saying or general rule of thumb that you found to be true for you again and again and again, what would that be? And so this is one of those, I'm going to quote some old interviews here, but outcomes over, oh man, I'm going to ruin it now. No, I'll skip that one because I can't remember exactly what I said now in this moment. But one was, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. These kinds of sayings.
So when later I will think of like 20 cool things.
No, no kidding.
But I'm really not great off the cuff. So I'm opening like.
That's okay.
I'm opening my phone because what I do is I jot down things that resonate with me. Is it okay if I cheat?
No, I just the first one that you see, I love this.
Yeah, because
I feel like
amazing. The first thing that jumped in my head that wasn't a quote, though, when you asked that question, the most important book I read in 2021 is called The Courage to Be Disliked. And it's by two Japanese philosophers. I don't want to mess up their names, but I think that everyone needs to read that because basically, it's freeing when you don't worry about whether people like you or not. If you just, like I said earlier, live according to your values and do what you know is right and let the rest go, it's so freeing. And so I wanted to throw that book out there. That was really a good one. But
that's good.
I don't.
No, hey, I'll take the book.
Yeah.
We'll count the book.
See, anything that's just. It's not in here, but I would say that, you hear a lot that the best things in life on the other side of discomfort. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think it's often true. that once you go through adversity, there's growth on the other side. If you can just get through it, and just, you know, there's always tomorrow. It'll always get better if you wait it out and just do the best you can.
Wow. I think both of those are great. I heard have the courage to be disliked, and the best things in life sometimes are on the other side of discomfort. So thank you, Kelly.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining me today and telling your story.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
All right. So with that, I'll say goodbye, everybody.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.